Well, folks, one thing I did in the session, I was in a session as an audience member before across the way, and since it was a sort of this conference table, what we could do is just go around and introduce all the people that are here, if you're comfortable with that. And so I'm Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the concurrent session, Money as Sustainable Fuel, Driving Politics and Environmental Policy. And we'll start off by if our panelists can introduce themselves.
I'm Tim Nockin, Texas Tech University.
James Browning, a regional state director for Common Cause.
Larry Pryor, I'm in the faculty at the Annenberg School, at the University of Southern California.
Clint
Wilder
with DNA. Dave Levitan, freelancer
and John Kramer, I used to be a journalist and a director of media relations at Vermont Law School.
Justin Harrison, a freelancer from California.
I'm from
Newark,
Denver.
I'm
a staff reporter
from the business paper.
Welcome.
Hey, I'm Judy Hayes from the Salt Lake Tribune.
Perry River National Parks Conservation Association.
I'm a Texas Tech student. Audio recording the session.
Right.
And Frank Masano, Bracewell Julian, Washington, D.C. office.
Okay. So I sort of decided about a year ago that this panel would be a good idea. I was still fresh from the conversation between Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin and what he thought was David Koch, the transcript which was provided. I have a copy of here if anyone would ever like to read it, and this is where the governor of Wisconsin thought he was talking to one of his large donors, and just a sort of an interesting insight into what is sometimes said, I guess, between politicians and people they think their donors. And then, of course, we've had during the course of this presidential year a few recorded conversations that were illuminating. And so I thought, oh, that's great. Let's have a little conversation about money in politics, and especially for SEJ, how they money might be influencing environmental policy. It comes in the mid of various ongoing campaigns. I was handed this dollar bill yesterday by another SEJ member. It says, it has a stamp on there, a corporation is not a person, money is not speech. So it's various little activities out in the community. Various signs that are out there, various groups raising various points, and let's talk about them. And we're going to start out with Mr. Browning from Common Cause, and go for it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, and great to be here with all of you. So I'm a regional state director. I cover about 10 of our offices in the Midwest and the Atlantic. I'm based in Pennsylvania, so it's a lot of states where the fracking boom is well underway, and some where it's just now beginning to gain steam. I want to talk about several dimensions of money and politics around fracking. Those will be campaign contributions and lobbying expenditures, other avenues of influence such as ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and a little bit around the implications of Citizens United for the whole debate around fracking. Now, I've worked for Common Cause for the better part of about 8 years, and at the beginning of that time, the oil and gas industry knew this day was coming, when the technology would work and there would be this much activity in these states. So long before there was an organized environmental movement or community movement in places where fracking was happening, there was a very organized push by the industry to educate lawmakers and candidates and other decision makers and to tell their side of the story. And for those of you who lobbied or spent time in state capitals, you've seen that part of the way the story is told, there are two worlds in these state capitals. There will be a hearing in Columbus or Harrisburg or Annapolis where to the casual observer it seems like the whole spectrum of the debate is represented, and everyone, whether it's the CEO of a gas company or someone who lives in a town where there have been problems with fracking, everyone has a chance to make their case. But what is not seen, and in some states is not really reported, is the extent to which there are similar, hearings going on at, a steakhouse or on a yacht or, some other junket the night before, the week before, where it's the exact same industry people and the exact same lawmakers having the same conversation in a very different way. So how can we measure the extent of the influence enjoyed by the industry people who have those kinds of relationships? You know, at the federal level, we tracked in a study we put out last year about $720 million in reported lobbying by companies engaged in fracking over the last 10 years. Take a state like Pennsylvania, it's been about $15 million. Now, what's really interesting is that Pennsylvania, during when things were really kind of heating up on fracking, was actually the only state in the country that didn't have a lobbying law requiring lobbyists to disclose the money they were getting paid by these companies and what they were doing with it, and even things like gifts and meals. And the Steelers have been in the Super Bowl a lot recently, and there have been a lot of junkets taking our Senate leadership to the Super Bowl to see the Steelers. Now, what's really interesting and important here is if you then go to a state like Ohio, which has a very weak lobbying law, all they require is disclosure of things like gifts and meals and trips and what are called entertainments. States that have weak lobbying laws like that, that don't capture the salaries, which is usually 80-90% of all of the money spent on lobbying, there's no way to tell that side of the story. And it's an incredibly important side of this story because it explains how the industry has been so successful in making their points. They have so many allies, they have so many champions in elected office and running for office, and this is a big piece of it. You know, I've been struck by some of the other panels by the question of how do we find the middle on this debate? How do we find an independent voice on this debate? And I think one reason that's so hard is because we're still missing so much information. And it could be information about the chemicals used in fracking. For us, it's especially we are missing information about all the money that's been spent and exactly what's going on here. So let me talk about that same challenge in the context of some of these other money and politics issues. Campaign contributions. You know, a state like Pennsylvania, which has no limits on campaign contributions, you know, you see the CEO of a natural gas company making $100,000, $200,000 contributions to the governor. You know, that gets people's attention as much as the number of zeros on the check. It can be the promise of someone, an aspiring candidate, who sees that and realizes, am I going to be with those guys or am I going to be against those guys? And what does it mean for me? You know, and we get asked, I mean, I think rightly so, all the time, you know, are you saying that the money buys, you know, votes? You know, it's not a question of flipping someone from red to green or yes to no. We all know there are 1,000 shades of gray, and this money pushes people a few shades brighter, a few shades darker, and if you do that with enough people, you affect the debate, you affect the outcome. What we hear from both, what I hear in 10 different states from whether it's a Republican caucus, a Democratic caucus, all the time, the debate in those caucuses behind closed doors is, did these guys give us the money they said they would give us? Because if they did, we'll debate this bill on the Senate floor or the House floor. And if they didn't, you know, we need to teach them a lesson. And this isn't even about passing a bill. This is about what's going to be debated publicly around the issue of fracking. So let me just quickly cover two other parts of this. If you're familiar with some of the stories recently that have come out around ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, this is a group that is actually registered as a charity, so they can take tax-deductible contributions from their members and others. It, until recently, had a lot of the biggest companies in America, oil and gas companies and chemical companies and the Koch brothers, but a lot of mainstream corporations as well, you know, Walmart, Coca-Cola, IBM. And it was only after the Trayvon Martin shooting that a lot of groups became more cautious in their dealings with ALEC. But from our perspective, the really troubling thing about this organization is that they have been using C3 tax-deductible funds to draft model legislation, especially around fracking, and push that out into the states. Now, what's so important about the model legislation drafted by ALEC dealing with fracking is that it has key loopholes in state disclosure laws that the industry needs and wants, specifically giving it the ability to not disclose chemicals that are deemed to be trade secrets or proprietary information. So this is a very important part of the debate at the state level. And then lastly, for now, you know, we have to talk about Citizens United and the new world that this has put us in. We're putting out a new report next Tuesday on the chemical industry and its political expenditure as a part of that will look at the effects of Citizens United and the millions more they're able to spend on elections now, and also the connection with the chemical industry spending and the fracking issue.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. And we'll turn it over next to Professor Nocken of Texas Tech to talk a little bit about more about Citizens United, talk a little bit about the Texas scene, and then go from there. Please,
yeah,
please go ahead.
A little bit of that, and just kind of how Poli-Sci approaches this topic. And I think Mr. Browning's presentation provides kind of the specific inside information that a lot of the things that we draw about campaign contributions, campaign spending, money in politics is unable to get at. So mine might present results that seem pretty benign, but keep that in mind as kind of the aim of what political science tries to do with what groups like Common Cause look at, and I think you can kind of see that they're not necessarily diametrically opposed. In the late 1800s, 1896, a guy by the name of William McKinley ran for president, and he had a political handler by the name of Mark Hanna who coined the phrase, money is the mother's milk of politics. And one of the implications from that election was some early efforts and significant efforts to regulate campaign finance, namely to make corporate contributions direct to candidates illegal, which came about in the early 1900s, and now it's not there. Other Supreme Court decisions and policy directives have been basically equating money with speech, because it's now a First Amendment issue. And when we equate money and campaign contributions with speech, that makes policymakers, gives them fewer tools or fewer kind of options to regulate campaign contributions. So because of this unique standing as speech, it makes it really kind of difficult to figure out how do we govern, regulate, monitor money in politics. Adding to that kind of conundrum is the fact that a couple of years ago in the case Citizens United that people will be referring to quite a bit, that First Amendment coverage applied back to contributions from corporations. So in my world, in the way political scientists now approach the study of campaign finance and expenditures in politics, it's like the Wild West out there. It really is evolving, it seems almost monthly. So I'm going to be at a loss to explain a lot of specifics, large part because I think they're still playing out, and we still don't know the implications of this, and that's kind of the world we're at. One of the things I think if we take a look at what people think about money in politics, and I always ask my students this, is do you think there's too much money in politics? Or do you think money in politics is this unholy marriage? I think universally we look at public opinion and people's gut reaction, there's an unsavory component to that. What I will also kind of argue, and what other kind of people argue, is one of the reasons we have that kind of uneasy feeling about that relationship is precisely because some of our campaign finance and campaign contribution regulations are working. Is we know how much money is in politics oftentimes, in certain elements of the political process, because the FEC requires disclosure. And that kind of performs this really bizarre function of keeping us informed, but also seeming to kind of fuel the fire of negativity. Now, of course, well, and then some people will say, well, take a look at other areas of American commerce, enterprise, financial dealings, and we're talking about comparing campaign expenditures on things like advertising with the amount of money spent on yogurt and soap, which I think is interesting in the sense we don't think of those as dangerous, but we do think of money in politics as that kind of unholy alliance. And that's not to wave our hands and say it's irrelevant or benign, but I think it is kind of important to understand that that's one component and one element of it that we have, that we're required to disclose if we make those contributions, those expenditures. So when we think about that unholy alliance, if we can borrow from public opinion kind of reactions to it, there seems to be this causal element, and he referenced this oftentimes too. And in political science, what we try to do is uncover causal relationships. And we think about this at a different level, a kind of a more aggregate, more general level than possibly Common Cause and certainly lobbyists look at. But one of the things we think about is, does it change people's mind? And I think clearly the notion was that we're not switching people who are generally environmental, kind of motivated to be environmentally friendly to start supporting fracking you know, on one vote because of a campaign contribution. And there's a couple reasons. I don't think either side wants to go down that path, because if we can prove a causal relationship between contribution and flip-flopping on big issues, you know, then we start getting into questions of legality. Why did they switch? Was it that payment? That probably happens. You know, clearly we see evidence of corruption, but those are the exception rather than the rule, I think, with regards to that. Now, what's the most common way that this probably works its way into the system? And we generally think, and I think this kind of is congruent with what the previous speaker mentioned, is we direct our resources, if we're in the game of lobbying, contributing, to people who generally support our ideas. So it's rather than trying to convert people from anti to pro, it's let's maintain our relationship with the people on the side that we take. And through that, then I think we get into some of the arguments you were making, we foster that relationship. We maintain friendships. We maintain access. And in that regards, it's a much more effective and efficient mechanism in influencing politics, but it's also one that's much harder from at least the political science context to really figure out how that works. It depends on personal relationships. It depends on contact. And, you know, one level that could be theoretically very useful in terms of sharing information. And on the other level, it can be raise some questions about, is it ethical to have used previous relationships to build on a current relationship to extract some sort of benefit from legislation? The other thing I think when we think about this is, and again, the previous speaker hit on this, is money is not kind of a monolithic force in politics, especially given the nature of campaign regulation, different organizations with different standing. Money is not money in the sense that the type of contributions we're looking at are very important to kind of giving us the correct picture in how to approach understanding what money in politics does. So, for instance, we see a lot of money, a lot of discussion about direct contributions. How much is so-and-so spending? How much is so-and-so contributing to candidates? That's still regulated, and at least at the national level, that is capped. So when we talk about the influence in terms of direct contributions, we're probably not seeing it there. Think about how much it costs to run for Senate in certain states. And then think about the limits that individuals are able, you know, there are ways to circumvent it, but generally, one check is a very small percentage of the amount of money that person will need to raise to run for the Senate. And again, we're not seeing vote buying. And when I say vote buying, I'm not talking about it in the sense of bribery, but trying to get people on the margin to flip, that probably not going on at that case. However, we are trying, certainly see that as a way to build relationships, maintain standing. Where I think the money in politics now raises a lot of serious questions, and these are the areas that, again, I don't know, and I think legal experts and practitioners with issues at hand are really driving home how dynamic the system is, are these new independent kind of organizations, super PACs, the types of entities that have arose after Citizens United. And the biggest issue, at least in my sense, that have normative implications for how the process works is the secrecy. And it's ironic, isn't it, that we equate money and politics with free speech, but one of the kind of hallmarks, I think, of the new system is people are able to speak by writing unlimited checks while also enjoying a shroud of anonymity in a lot of regards. So there's something I think, again, I don't recall the Supreme Court case offhand, but I think that was something that they assumed Congress would fix. Congress hasn't. So we're having a world now where huge donors can do so secretly, you know, essentially in secret, to gain influence. And that raises the question, A, is it First Amendment protection? And B, is that good for democracy? Unfortunately, political scientists don't often have those answers, but that's a serious implication that a lot of us deal with. Now, one of the things we hear about is in Texas is we have a situation like some of the states described earlier where individuals can give essentially unlimited contributions to candidates, but they have to be disclosed. So we know Bob Perry, a home builder from the Houston area, hundreds of thousands to candidates in Texas, but also to some of these super PACs. And one of the emails I received from Chuck beforehand, several million dollars to the Romney campaign.
There's an AP article, maybe you folks have seen this, an AP article today about the big givers to Republicans and Romney and Obama.
Yeah, and a lot of the guy by the name of James Leninger, who was really interested in vouchers. So he gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to candidates who shared his view on vouchers. So in Texas, we have kind of the unlimited contribution component with disclosure, which is kind of an interesting combination. Now, in thinking about Texas, it's kind of hard to figure out what the effect is going to be, because for those of us who live here, we know it's a solidly Republican state. So we point to this, you know, how effective are these contributions? Well, they're reaching Republicans, but they're reaching people who are likely sympathetic anyways. So we think about in terms of environmental policy, Texas is probably not a very good case to look at for kind of a relationship between environmental policies and political contributions. It could be in the sense that it pushed things further towards industry in certain cases, but it's also pretty likely these are folks that are supportive of industry in the first place. That said, what's kind of interesting is what we've seen in Texas a couple times, and we're seeing it play out now with respect to pipelines. There's been a couple articles in the paper with a TransCanada pipeline outfit creating a lot of ill will between a traditional conservative Republican constituency, rural interests, ranchers, and farmers who have seen government and oil industry using eminent domain and tools of that sort take away access to public land to build this pipeline. Likewise, we saw this in Texas several years ago during Rick Perry's early term of trying to use taking powers to build what he called the Trans-Texas Corridor, a new transportation initiative. Again, constituents who he normally can count on turned into political adversaries on this. So I guess to end on, if we call it an up note, because I don't think money in politics is going away anytime soon, the best we can maybe hope for is some more disclosure. But what we see when we actually have policies that impact people in specific locations on the ground, sometimes politics makes for strange bedfellows. So if we see a generally conservative ranching, farming constituency, seeing their livelihood possibly threatened or their ability to go about making livelihood changed because of policies that, you know, corporate entities might be thrusting upon them with the help of government, we do see the possibility for change. Now, I don't know if that's going to change, but at least there's a notion of constituents still matter in some regards. And I think one of the things we forget about in the politics and money debate is that constituents still matter. Now, the problem there is sometimes constituents don't know and constituents don't care. And in that environment, there we have the possibility for, at the margins, money making a bigger difference than when constituents are well-organized, well-informed, and unified in a sort of response. So that's kind of where we as political scientists, what we try to bring to the table. And it's a little different and a little less, I think, kind of more general, which sometimes loses some transferability when we look at specific issues.
So. Thank you, Professor Dakin. Next up is Frank Maizano, Bracewell and Giuliani. And so, Frank, among my many questions is, what do donors expect when they give to politicians? Maybe you can answer that.
Yeah, I'm from a very different place than a lot of people. I'm from inside the Beltway, right? And this is a livelihood inside the Beltway. Okay? So, you know, honestly, if we talk about where politics is in, money is in politics today. And it certainly has been there in the past, and it will continue to be there. And I got to say, I probably agree with Professor Nockin on most of his points that he made, because he outlines very clearly some of the challenges that we face. Now, Jim's comments too also outline some of the challenges we face because of the story. It's a lot easier to tell from his perspective in terms of creating a conspiracy of challenges that this will always be a crisis and that will always be buying influence and things like that. And I just don't see it that way from the start because of the way the game operates in Washington. And you may not like the game in Washington. You may not like the game in a state legislature. You may not like it at a local level. But that's the way that the game is. And you always play within the rules of the game to be able to do the best you can. I disagree that money influences more than it doesn't. There are lots of things that influence people, and a lot of it is relationship-based. you know, I always talk about Jack Abramoff as the best example of versus, you know, the kind of operation that we have at Bracewell, which is the big difference. You know, Jack Abramoff bought access and ended up in jail. Okay? Bracewell Giuliani, and before that Bracewell Patterson, for 50 years has operated a lobbying operation built on substance and expertise and its ability to build relationships. And we're relied on for that because of many of the same reasons that you journalists often call me. Because you know I have a good source, you know I'm reliable, and you know where I'm coming from, but you also know that you're going to get what you need relatively quickly. That's the same thing that happens in Washington, D.C. in the political environment. You have lots of politicians and, frankly, lots of staff who, and trust me, I'm 44 years old right now. I worked 9.5 years on Capitol Hill from age 21 to 30, right? And when I worked between age 21 to 30 on Capitol Hill, trust me, I knew everything. Okay? Until I got off of Capitol Hill and realized that I virtually knew nothing. Okay? So, when you're dealing with these large, complex issues such as fracking or any other transmission policy or many of the environmental issues we deal, energy issues we deal with, you know, a 23-year-old staffer out of college who this congressman is relying on isn't necessarily going to be versed on all the ins and outs of the Clean Air Act or any kind of other thing that is going to be need to make good, sound policy. So they're going to need to rely on lobbyists, and money is part of that process. So it's not any, it's not a bad story, it's not anything that should be part of a conspiracy theory or anything like that. It's just something that's part of the current way that we operate. I also add a lot of times, too, that it really costs a lot of money to move the needle. And I think a lot of people don't judge it as to be worth the cost a lot of times. You know, API has invested 30-something million dollars in a big ad campaign in their Vote for Energy campaign. Has it really moved the needle in the country and influenced politicians? Maybe on the edges a little bit by talking about the issues, but pretty much everybody is where they were when you know, from the polling data we saw after the Macondo spill, which said most of the people still support offshore drilling, right? 50-something percent, 60% still supported offshore drilling. So has that campaign API has conducted changed the dynamic at all? Probably not. Okay, same goes for the clean coal people. Same goes for the American Wind Energy Association. AWEAS conducted a two-year-long campaign to get the PTC renewed, the production tax credit renewed. And it's fallen on deaf ears in both with Republicans and Democrats in Congress. So now you can say, well, what? And they have a big PAC and they make lots of PAC contributions. Well, why didn't that work then? Because sometimes fundamental problems and fundamental structural challenges of the legislative process get in the way of you succeeding. So that's why I say money is important, money plays a role, but money's influence is not nearly as big as Common Cause and other groups would like to make it seem. Let me just mention a couple things about Citizens United. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not involved in the intricacies of it, but I am a Washington insider of sorts. Since having anytime you're in the same place for 20 years, you kind of become an insider, no matter if you are smart or not. So, and I'm the not smart side. But anyway, Citizens United to me is very interesting because it really did open up a lot of doors. But it's funny, the people who many of the opponents thought would take advantage of those doors really aren't taking advantage of those doors. From a corporate perspective, we heard when Citizens United happened, oh my God, all these companies are going to start pouring money into X, Y, and Z issues. And that has not happened. And that has not happened for a number of reasons. One, because public companies, public corporations have to report. They have 10K obligations. They have shareholder obligations. And frankly, shareholder meetings where you have to report these things, it's not as easy to say you spent in a bad year, lots of money trying to
you know, to donate to politicians. They generally don't think that that's the best use of the money if the number is outweighing the opportunity. So I don't think that it's had as big an impact as some people in that arena would like to think in the public corporate arena. But there's no doubt where it really has had an impact is in the private side. People who don't have to report, and that would be the Kochs as one example of that, they don't care how much they spend. Sheldon Adelson single-handedly kept the presidential primaries going for an extra 3 weeks because Newt Gingrich never would have survived without Newt Gingrich, purely on his ability to campaign and continue the campaign going, never, it was like a shell. He never would have been able to do that without the millions of dollars that Sheldon Adelson was handing to him to run a campaign. So in a sense, and you can argue, as Professor Notkin did, maybe that's a good thing because it extended the conversation regarding the presidential nomination for the Republican Party for an extra 6 or 8 weeks, which gave the news media more to talk about. Same thing goes for Santorum. Santorum was funded by a bunch of 529 guys who, you know, kept him afloat for those years too, when structurally the only candidate who was a sound candidate from a campaign perspective in terms of infrastructure and fundraising and things like that was Romney. So I think from the private side, there is a big difference that it's made. Now, one thing I would say, though, is don't confuse energy companies that are conservative with conservatives that just happen to own an energy company. Okay? Because I think the reason the Kochs spend so much money is not because they represent an oil company or a refiner or anything like that. They spend as much money as they do because they don't care and they want to, and they're conservatives. And they want to spend money on conservative causes. And they just happen to be an oil company or a refiner. So, you know, I know my friends in the environmental community like to say, oh my God, the Kochs are trying to buy the energy industry, and, you know, they're doing it because they're bashing green energy, which I happen to like and support and work with. They're bashing green energy because they don't like it, not because they're an oil company. Okay? So, they're conservative oil company. And finally, the last thing I'll say is that enviros spend a lot of money themselves on these issues, and that oftentimes gets left to the side. I mean, and we can talk about this more. The League of Conservation Voters has gone crazy this year, spending money in races all over the country for peak candidates that they support, and not just federal candidates, but state candidates and things like that. Jay Inslee, who is a congressman from Washington, is running for governor. Had $700,000 donated to him through the League of Conservation Voters Fund. The League of Conservation Voters has, along with some other groups, played a much larger role in campaign spending too. So don't forget about that aspect of things too. It really does. And, you know, again, it's less Republican versus Democrat. A lot of times it's more regional-based interests because there's lots of Democrats in Louisiana that the energy industry is big fans of, and there's lots of Republicans in other places that, you know, environmentalists are fans of. So that's another thing that we have to remember as we talk about these issues.
Well, thank you, and I want to give you two gentlemen a chance to respond a little bit later on, but if you'd like, but I want to throw it open for questions now from our SEJ members here especially, and try to speak as loudly as you can, but I think I will be trying to repeat the questions for the purpose of the tape recorder here that's recording for our other members who are not able to attend this session. So who's up with a question? Anybody? Speak up or I'll ask.
Sure, I'll go.
Could you identify yourself again, too?
Yeah, Clint Wilder with Clean Edge. Frank, about the Citizens United not opening the floodgates for corporate money. But so, you know, obviously we have record amounts of money being spent on the presidential campaign and Senate, Massachusetts, and other places. Is it more wealthy individuals rather than corporations?
And again, I think you want to.
Is it more wealthy corporations than individuals?
Right? I think the answer to that question is simply yes. And maybe Professor Notkin has
a sense of that as well. You know, people are spending their own money more aggressively. Some of my colleagues at Bracewell, they make more in individual contributions to individual members that they like and things that they like, rather than going through the firm pack or, you know, getting other clients to join in and things like that. So, yeah, people have, and you know, we're obviously a much smaller environment than somebody who has the ability to stroke a $1 million check to somebody because they feel like it, or a $50,000 check. But remember, parties generally, the Republican and Democratic national parties generally, have taken checks $50,000, $100,000 for years from people who have gone into the general funds for those, which they then spread out to other candidates. So, you know, this is, again, not a new phenomenon, that individual high-wealth donors who may have five houses and a place in France and hundreds of cars and things like that, have money to burn, will then take their game and put it into politics. And so, you know, again, I think Professor Nockin mentioned some of the things that are really important, and that is we have to disclose a lot of these things, and disclosure then becomes the vehicle for perhaps shaming people into not spending that money, or, you know, I mean, like I said, with corporations. Corporations, you know, they have to report. They have an obligation to shareholders, and if shareholders are going to, you know, push back on what they do, then they have a problem. So they haven't been as aggressive to move in that direction. Well, of course, the Koch brothers, other than media scrutiny or, you know, liberal environmental groups protesting them or things like that, they don't have a check against what they want to do, especially if they don't really care.
For all the people who disagree with the findings in Citizens United, a lot of people are surprised to learn that the Supreme Court itself has issued opinions that directly contradict the findings about money and politics and corruption. This Supreme Court, a few months before Citizens United in January of 2010, they issued a ruling in a case involving a judge in West Virginia who had taken a lot of money from a mine and then made a deciding vote. He was the deciding vote in several cases in a row in the mine's favor. And so Justice Kennedy voted the other way and said, yes, there is a danger here of the appearance of corruption. And obviously these are people with a special expertise and concern about the integrity of the judiciary, and they found that this created the appearance of corruption. Now, you can only conclude, putting these two decisions side by side, that they are less concerned, or they somehow think that money plays a different role in other kinds of elections, which is that's a pretty hard thing to square. I'd like to add two quick points. One about Citizens United, which is, you know, we talk about moving the needle. You know, the needles move all the time in ways that we don't know about and never hear about. And that's when certain people are thinking of running for office, and they look through their contacts and business people, and who's going to be with me and who's going to be against me, and they add it up. Can I win this thing? Do I want to spend 2 years of my life doing this? And if they know the super PAC money is going to come in big against them, that's a big disincentive from running. And I definitely agree it would be a mistake to just focus on the conservative side of this. I mean, if you take a comparable environmental issue for a couple of years ago, the Deepwater Horizon spill, when Congress was starting to move to crack down and better regulate offshore drilling, the thing that moved the needle in that debate, it wasn't necessarily the oil and gas money, it was when labor got involved and started fighting this and became concerned that this would cost jobs. And the influence of all the labor money was brought to bear in that fight, and that was the deciding moment that turned that debate around.
Well, I think that's true, too, with the service unions. The service unions have been super aggressive. I mean, you know, manufacturing unions have lost a lot of clout, let's be clear. Union memberships are about the same since times. It's just the adjustment of service unions going up and manufacturing unions going down. And certainly that changes the dynamic of the politics of the union. The service unions are tend to be, especially on the environment, much more liberal than many of the manufacturing unions are. And of course that plays an impact in a lot of the politics of the game.
Which is why we're seeing Las Vegas as ground zero in the presidential race, mm-hmm. I think, is service unions and a lot of the labor forces there are pouring a lot of money and possible voters.
You know, I think a lot of environment, I'm Judy Bates, the Salt Lake Tribune, a lot of reporters are surprised that climate change has not made any substantive appearance on the horizon. To what extent do you think money is playing a role in silencing an issue that, at least for a lot of people, is a pretty big deal?
I think part of it is the successful campaign by the natural gas industry. Before I ever knew what fracking was, I knew that clean blue flame logo that appeared on top of a lot of the liberal blogs that I lead, and it's a very pleasing thing. It's a very nice idea that with this new energy source, we're going to clean up the air and have cheaper energy and more jobs and stop sending money to governments that support terrorism and on and on and on. And it's a brilliant campaign. They did a great job, and I think they have in part neutralized some people who would otherwise be more vocal and who actually, in fact, they actually see, this is how far they've moved the needle. They actually see, talking about fracking as this is the answer to global warming. Right? We're not just promoting industry. We're gonna save the planet with fracking. I mean, that's how successful they've been. Now, to the other part of your question, I would say, I mean, it's complicated about the kinds of choices people have in elections, and I think a lot of the people who are very concerned about global warming don't have good electoral options, even if they like Democrats and then they're not talking about it. I mean, if we had a system like they do in California now, we're in congressional primaries, the two top vote getters, regardless of of party, advance the general election. If you had a system like that across the country, I suggest you'd have a lot more choices on issues like global
warming. I'll take kind of a different tack. One of the things I think we see with global warming is, or climate change, because again, labels make a big difference, is ideology plays a role in what people think. But beyond that, I think if you take a look at the numbers, and there was a recent poll, I didn't read the article too closely, but the number of people who are now saying, hey, this is happening and this is caused by humans is increasing. But think about what that means. I drove over here. It's maybe a 10-minute walk, but I got lost behind on my plan, so I drove rather than walked. Americans like cars. We like the convenience of our cars. So do we know we're contributing to the problem? Yeah, but we probably do it anyways. The other thing is, so the implication associated with fixing that part of our lives is pretty clear. Do I have to walk to work, take a bus? That's a lot less convenient. We could do it, but there are costs to that, not financial, but in terms of lifestyle choices. The other thing, I think the bigger effects are those that we don't know how they're going to come yet, is subtle changes in, I have a colleague in the biology department who brings people down to Big Bend, and he's seeing the effects in terms of plant life and animal life in Big Bend. Well, when I get up, and I think that's a horrible thing that could happen. But I have to admit, I still get up and I drive to work every day, knowing that I'm probably a good, not the only cause, but me and everyone else who drove to work is doing that. We don't know the long-term implication of that. And finally, if you take a look at voting in general, there are tons of issues people vote on. But for the most part, we rank order them. We have issues that are most important and less important. So what are most important in this election? It's pocketbook issues. So while a lot of us might think climate change is an important topic, it's probably the kind that's not going to get on the agenda right away. Why? Because there's a tax concern that we have to address. There's appropriations for all sorts of things that need to be sorted out. So from our perspective as voting studies, it's a complicated process.
And that's a good segue to what I say. And I just did an interview with Richard Harris of NPR about this before we came out here. Here, climate change is the popular topic. We like to talk about it. And all the polls and all the rankings and orders, it ranks at the bottom every time. And there are various reasons why, because as Professor Nockin said, we can't see the long-term outcomes. We don't see the lifestyle changes we have to take, or maybe we do, we just ignore them. I also think that this is an incredibly complex issue that's just impossible to explain in the soundbite world, the TV ad world funded by a lot of the money in politics that we're in. And so, you're not going to get people moving the needle on an issue that they don't particularly, and I say it this way, but this isn't, that they don't particularly care about, that is hugely complex to explain. And three, something that you can't really figure out what impact it's going to have down the road. So all of those things together don't lend it to be one that money is going to have a lot of influence on.
Quick follow-up. I would agree with you, except look at what's happening with the debt. The debt is extremely complicated, and most people don't know their, you know how to deal with that and have reasonable solutions. And yet, that is the big issue. That was made a big issue, and so that's what I was asking about the money. And
you know
what's
how
the
you
money
know how
doing?
That's a big issue, though. There's a giant debt clock in the middle of Times Square that just rolls.
It's been there for decades.
Yeah, it's been there for decades.
We like debt.
Yeah.
You know, let's face it, why? We pay lower taxes, get more services, and we just thrust into the future. That's the free lunch.
Yeah.
So when we complain about debt, and people complain, regardless if they're Democrats or Republicans,
yes.
we're all to blame because we're getting exactly what we as constituents want, which is more stuff for less money.
Question, please identify.
John Kramer, Vermont Law School. But recognizable impact from climate change, if it's not happening now with the massive wildfires and dried up streams and drought and severe weather events, I mean, that's having direct, demonstrable impact in a variety of ways, whether that's actually caused by climate change. But those kinds of things are happening all over. If that's not going to raise the priority of climate change on voters, what will? I mean, it's not something that's, you know, you're going to have severe weather effects in the future, massive wildfires. They're happening now in tons of spots. What's it going to take to
Well, I've been following
questions. And the question was, isn't there evidence of climate change happening now, and why isn't that affecting voters now? What's it going to take?
Yeah,
I mean, I've been involved, and I just jump in here quickly first because I've been involved in the climate change issue now since 1995. That's going on almost 20 years. So I've been around the block a few times on this issue, and we've had the same type of arguments for the last 15 years about climate change, and it's causing hurricanes, and it's causing wildfires, and there always is a question that it's doing that, and then the next year we don't have any hurricanes. And, you know, so then we have a very short memory in this country with people. And that's a big problem. That's one of the problems why it doesn't register. And people just don't tend to want to believe that, you know. And then there's lots of different science that, you know, I mean, look, the hurricane causation issue is a great one. You had some really good scientists from MIT, Carrie Manuel, and Georgia Tech, Judy Curran, and some NOAA guys and some, you know, National Hurricane Center guys and Pelkey and those guys who are famous for doing the hurricane forecast. You had them basically clashing over with some great scientific debates. If you're a fan of scientific debates, you want to pay attention to what those scientific debates were, because they were real quality discussions. And they came to the conclusion that, well, we're just going to, some are right, some are not right.
To bring this around to fracking, you know, the scale of the changes that are talked about with climate change on the big level are actually comparable to the scale of the change that's happening in some of the communities where there is fracking in Pennsylvania. You have the whole landscape altered. You have thousands of truck trips in and out of these sites every day. You have huge open waste pools. You have Pennsylvania as the only state where they can still just dump the fracking wastewater into the river. You have the accidents that have happened in Pennsylvania. You have all the uncertainty about the safety of these wells going forward in the future, and the fact that a certain percentage eventually fail and leak. You have all the secrets around the chemicals, all the secrets around the money. And to go back to the point you made about that, there's an interesting dynamic here where there are conservative areas or rural areas who are seeing, you know, some very serious impacts from environmental issues, and it kind of opens things up a little bit. And I think it creates the possibility here for, you know, maybe people in conservative areas living with this stuff, urban and suburban environmentalists, to talk to each other and find some common ground and some common concerns. But if the whole idea of, you know, your environment is going to be radically altered, when that actually happens in communities, and I've met with organic dairy farmers in Bradford County, Pennsylvania, who have refused to lease their land for fracking but are surrounded by fracking and now have gelatinous water coming out of their tap, you know, that's the kind of thing that mobilizes an entire community.
Can I follow up?
Quick follow-up.
I would say, you know, an example near and dear to my heart, living in Lubbock, is dryness. We don't have a lot of water. We're now in the process of pumping water from a reservoir 40 miles away, which is lower than we are. But is our water issue attributable to climate change? Absolutely. But we don't approach it as a climate change issue, right? Wildfires aren't necessarily approached as a climate change issue. hurricanes aren't approached like that. We don't fit the whole pattern together. We like as humans to fit patterns together, but when we're talking about water issues in Lubbock, it's going to be about pumping water uphill as opposed to climate change. If it's about wildfires in California and the West.
Yeah,
and it makes it hard. You're right, that certainly contributes, but the proximate cause is not the long-term effect, which makes it really hard to do.
What strikes me as interesting...
You can say your name again, please.
Hey, my name is Larry Pryor. I'm at the Annenberg School for Communication, and so I work on the communication side of this issue. And what really impresses me about this panel is the different viewpoints that you have, because coming from California, I just couldn't be more in disagreement with a Texas viewpoint and an inside the Beltway viewpoint. From my viewpoint, you're way behind the curve. And I think that the recent polling, particularly that just came out of Yale, would indicate that there is a change in public attitude towards climate. And we've been through one of the worst summers and one of the worst years we've ever had. And that the lived experience that people are going through is having an impact on their viewpoint. And I think that you're really not appreciating. See, you had this question here, do constituents still matter? And from my perspective in California, looking at Washington, the answer is no. The oil industry, the fossil fuel industry, is controlling what goes on in Congress, and that's why nothing ever happens there that would satisfy those of us constituents around the country who are concerned about climate change. It's a rigged deal. I mean, I really do believe, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but I don't see any response in Congress to the concerns that we have in California. And we're having a cap and trade bill, law go into effect next month. So we're walking the walk and not just talking the talk.
I mean, I'm here as a political scientist, so I'm not here to advocate Texas is right by any stretch. There's a lot we do here I like and a lot we don't. But the other thing is what I do study is Congress. So I think the effects that you're talking about certainly probably do happen in Congress and very likely might have something to do with money. The problem is they're not events, right? Congress has an agenda. People compete to get on the agenda. Certain people are more effective on getting on the agenda than others. So sometimes people win by having issues not get on the agenda. And I think, too, if you take a look at our system of government, it's a lot easier to have stuff not happen than to have stuff happen. So the fact that certain interests might be advantaged with the status quo policy right now, that's a lot easier to defend. So what you're finding, though, in California, while in the national debate, Congress might not be taking up those issues, it seems California has.
And the cities.
Well, but I think also, too, though, you have a grand view of California, though, because California has had its disastrous environmental or energy policies come forward as well, the zero emissions mandate, one of them, where you had all the zero emissions electric cars that were going to be sold in California by a certain date. And, of course, now Palm Springs has a bunch of golf carts that meet the mandate before it was just summatively, they summed it up and just threw it away because it couldn't move the market. And your fuels policy is an absolute disaster, which is why when you had a refinery go down and the state as an island couldn't get fuel from other places, whereas other places, parts of the country, if they had a refinery incident, they could take fuels from a different place in a different pipeline and move
them
around.
It's a very complex issue, and it's very poorly understood. And the editorial in the Wall Street Journal several days ago was entirely wrong.
I don't even pay attention to what the Wall Street Journal says from their editorial perspective.
Well, they said the same thing you just said.
But the reality is, it's because it is an island. And they have their own fuel standards, and they have years for the reasons that the state implemented. And I mean, look, I'm working with Bright Source Energy on their renewable energy plan. The LA Times is beating them over the head because they're saying the solar projects are costing too much. Well, the reason that you have to buy the higher priced power is because you're the ones who decided that they needed a renewable portfolio standard of 33%, and that was passed by Schwarzenegger. So it's not a Republican or a Democrat thing. It's a policy prescription that is not funded by money in politics. It's funded by an agenda that's driven by, the folks who think that's the right thing to do. And the consequences are being played out when events like this happen. And so, we do see those type of situations happen. And, that's you have to lay in the bed that the policymakers in your state or in your country or in the UN make.
Mr. Browning, and then other questions.
I'll try to say something illuminating about the difference between national and state politics. I think it's true there's some very important differences in the role of money. Of course, what's key with the whole fracking debate is the degree to which it's been punted to the states. And it's much easier for an industry to move a governor or a state legislature, especially over a long period of time, than it is to move Congress. And, you know, I work in 10 state legislatures, and a lot of them, you know, they don't even have the 23-year-old staffer guarding the door. They are highly, highly dependent on the lobbyists who are there every day to let them know what is going on. And fracking is such a complicated subject, and the industry has had a real running start with a lot of these folks. And I think that explains a lot of their success. And unlike the federal level, where you at least have to disclose lobbying expenditures, in a lot of these states, there's nothing, and that side of the story is never told. And what happens is, if you do have strong sunshine laws like that in place, every single article in the newspaper, the hundreds of articles written about an issue, and it could be something else like tobacco, over a decade, that's always there framing the debate. You know, the industry guy said, no, this isn't, you know, this is a terrible bill, and the person who got cancer said, you know, I need this protection. If in every single story you have numbers spent by, you know, the industry and the numbers spent by the other side, that matters, and that changes the debate. And in so many states where fracking is happening, the laws aren't strong enough to tell that side of the story. Now, you can, you know, people who argue about the ability of billions of dollars to influence policy, you know, they can be called conspiracy theorists. But you can't call someone a conspiracy theorist if they're just calling for disclosure of all that money.
Back there, would you say who we are?
Yes, Nate Selfridge. I'm a freelance reporter. And this question is to a point that Professor Nauke made about the distinction between contributions, reinforcing access or reinforcing a position versus swaying or changing position. And try to have that characterization, right? But I'm just not so sure you can make that distinction, because money does often play a factor in one way or another in the origin of those positions. Not always, but often. And also, even if you're not influencing them to change, you may be influencing them not to change. I just wonder what the rest of you think about that distinction. And maybe it's a continuum.
I happen to agree with Professor Nauken, mostly because, being a person who makes decisions on who we're contributing to each and every day, pretty much. I mean, well, not every day, but during campaign season, it seems like every day. You know, we're making contributions based on, one of the first questions we say to ourselves is, do we work with him? What is our relationship to him? You know, how often do we talk to him? You know, and that begets people that you're regularly dealing with. They don't ask you for money if they don't know you necessarily. And so the relationships that we have and the people that we've worked with on oil and gas issues over the years are the people that we deal with. Or the people who we deal with from a regional perspective, a Texas delegation, or we have a client that has a facility in the middle of Iowa, and that congressman is a guy that we're supporting. Or a good example for us is First Energy was one of our big clients. And First Energy said, hey, by the way, we like Tim Ryan, who's a congressman, young Ohio congressman from Ohio, who's got a pretty bright future, probably, most people think. And so we asked for some PAC money amongst our PAC board, and we said, sure, he seems like a good guy. He's on appropriations. We worked with him before. So there's a case, and I happen to know him personally. So I was the one who kind of shepherded it. But it was a relationship. It was an opportunity to work with him on appropriations issues. That it was an opportunity to work with him because he was friends of First Energy and, you know, often worked with First Energy because he's a moderate Democrat on power plant issues and things like that. And so that's kind of what led to the decision to give him. And, you know, we didn't give him $5,000 or max out to him. We made a $1,000 contribution for a PAC event, and went to it, and, you know, that's kind of how the decision was made. So I do think that in most cases it is a relationship where you're working with people who you already agree with, for the most part.
Yeah, and I'm not saying this never happens. I mean, we look at as political science, we look at this in general. And there's a case, if this guy changed his position for $1,000, I think a couple things would happen. It would send up a lot of signals to a lot of people, including constituents. Because we remember John Kerry and the flip-flops that came from that campaign. It's bad to change your position. And members of Congress, if you look at their voting records and in the aggregate over time, rarely change because constituents know this. Now, on the flip side, I think something that might speak to what you were talking about, take a look at the biggest campaign recipients. And, you know, clearly it's majority party. It's always the majority party that's going to get more. But when you look at the members of the minority party who do really well, who are they? The people in the leadership. So even though Nancy Pelosi might not be a big friend of big oil or manufacturing in some respects, she's still going to receive a lot of contributions from those outfits. Why? Because they know she may very well be speaker again. Now, what are they getting for that? They're not sure, but they're probably thinking that being on her radar screen is with contributions is better than not, which might be, you know, at the margins affecting how she behaves. But there again, we don't know. But she gets those money from those kind of agency industries, which we wouldn't necessarily think she would necessarily be the kind of target that they'd select.
And I would add to that, we have lots of Democrats in our office, and they like Nancy Pelosi, even though maybe she doesn't like our positions too. And so we have one partner in our firm who is used to work for the feminist majority, which is a much different position than many of our conservative Democrats take. But certainly working with Nancy Pelosi and her working with Nancy Pelosi gives us more options. And so this is the exact conversation that we had over a contribution from our PAC to the Pelosi leadership PAC. And the person who delivered that was the person who she knew. So it's a relationship issue again.
Time for one more question, and then I'll ask for a summary. But Sally?
I'm Sally Deneen. I'm a freelance writer in Seattle. Frank, can you tell us, you said that you get, during the campaign season, you get a lot of requests for money. How many requests a day do you get? Can you give us a typical kind of phone call? And how do you go into the decision about whether to give money, and how much do they ask for?
Well, generally, I can start with the last one because it's the easiest. They generally, if they like you and know you, and you've worked with them a lot, and, you know, like, let's just say, a certain Democratic congressman from Houston who knows Bracewell very well, who also happens to represent a bunch of the oil and gas industry, that would be the type of guy who we would max out to. And so they would, but generally it's in the $1,000 range to the $5,000 range. And sometimes it's for primary, and sometimes it's for general, even if they don't have a primary, okay? And there are certain people who we make those decisions for. Most of the time, it's for $1,000. But, you know, the answer to the first part of the question is you get a lot of them every day, especially if you happen to unluckily get on the fax or email list of one of the fundraisers who happens to represent a lot of different guys. Because I think they somehow share their lists from time to time. We seem to be getting more and more and more. And I will tell you that a majority of them just are kind of said, oh, hey, so-and-so from Kansas is having a fundraiser. Great. In the circular file. Right? But there are often times where you will take one of those and say, this is a guy who we should know, or we should be working with more, or we should have, but do we give to him? We check the list. Because every year at the beginning of the year, we go through our list and suggest who should be targets for us for giving this year. And we're not alone in doing this. I think PAC boards across the board do the same thing, whether you're a trade association, whether you're a company, or whether you're a lobbying firm, a law firm. So the numbers are a lot, especially, the numbers are more around, well, actually, the numbers slow down as you get to within 2 or 3 weeks because they can't make and they can't raise any more money from you because of requirements and things like that. So the busiest time is probably 2 months before election back to any kind of requisite primary that they may have had. And then depending on if it's a senator or if it's a House member, you know, you might get 2 or 3 or 4 solicitations from them every year. For different and various events that they're having. And sometimes members like to have events that are fun, like, oh, we're going to a concert or a basketball game and we have a skybox. Sometimes they just have a local small event with people. So it varies to the personality of the individual who's asking for the money. So That generally is how it works, though, and I would say that we probably act on maybe 15 or 20% of the solicitations that we get, and the numbers for us aren't that big. So,
let's sneak in a quick question.
I'd like to have the perspective of all three of you.
And would you say you're...
Oh, Glenn Luan, freelancer from Ottawa, Canada. I'd like to have the perspective from all of you on how you perceive the influence of the dollars that are provided by the Koch brothers to the 15, 16 foundations, institutes, think tanks, whatever that they fund. Is it effective? Is it not effective? Does it just make them feel good? I'm curious.
How much do the Koch brothers' money affect the think tank, various think tanks?
Well, yeah. Obviously it does.
Yeah. How much?
I'd say all of the above, to use an energy term.
I see it from an interesting angle because they're very involved in academics. They provide a lot of money in some ways, and I'm sure there's a broader angle that they're pursuing as conservatives, as you mentioned. But one of the things they pay a lot of money to do is bring kids out to places and study kind of old philosophers, free market stuff. So, you know, what that gets them, I'm not sure. Maybe they find the next Hayek or something among these high school kids and college kids. And I'm not sure if that's their end goal or not, but like I tell my students, if you're interested in this and want to go somewhere on someone else's dime and read philosophers, do it. However, know who's behind the money. Now maybe they have a kind of a farm team of young Koch brothers coming up. I'm not sure. But I think part of it is they're just really interested in that kind of thing and as part of the larger conservative message they're trying to pursue.
I mentioned this before. I think one of the Koch brothers' most successful ventures that they're really backing has been ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which drafts, it registers a charity, and yet they draft model legislation and lobby all over the country. And what was originally conceived as a way of generating pro-business legislation moved into other areas, covering gun laws, for example, covering the standard ground gun law that was an issue in Florida with the Trayvon Martin incident, and that's why a lot of companies finally backed out of ALEC. They've been very active on the voter ID issue, which I know is big here in Texas and in Pennsylvania, where I am. And so all of these very mainstream companies, I mean, people who run big box stores, software companies, soda companies, wound up, in part because of the Koch's influence, entangled in this organization that's trying to keep people from voting on election day, that's trying to privatize prisons, that's doing all of these other things that are way outside of its original mandate, and I think that speaks to the success of what the Koch's put together.
I guess I was thinking more in terms of environmental issues, the global warming, alternative energy, and so forth.
Let me just add one thing to Jim's point, which is that they do have some influence, but as the influence starts to become more known and more successful, let's say, they tend to draw opponents too. And so it becomes, like with ALEC, like with the membership of the Global Climate Coalition back in the late 90s, activist groups tend to make these public pronouncements and make them campaigns to change the direction of these things, and a lot of times they either find new ones or they move on again. So it seems to be, again, like a never-ending cycle of sorts. There are lots of groups, especially in Washington, that are able to take money from foundations and other things, environmental groups included. And I think that you'll see that all the groups kind of are doing the same thing, in that they find different groups that they can support or be like-minded with, and then if something comes up that it becomes uncomfortable, they move that money into another place, and it becomes another foundation.
So let me ask each of the three speakers, finally, to, if you'd like, take 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. What's sort of a take-home tip for the reporters here that maybe they're going to write more about this, maybe they want to write about locally. Mr. Browning, you first.
Sure. I think I'd like to just give two examples raising questions about the role of money, either on a single vote or over time. Following fracking, you're probably familiar with the term the Halliburton loophole, which is when in 2004, 2005, Dick Cheney and Halliburton got an exemption put into that year's Energy Policy Act, which exempted fracking from EPA review, which is pretty extraordinary. And if you look at where the money went on that vote, the people who voted in favor of the Halliburton loophole got an average of about $70,000 from the industry, and those who voted against got about an average of $10,000. Now, there's just an amazing example of what I'm going to call vote buying in New York State recently, which has been underreported because a lot of outlets like the New York Times like the result, which is, and this is, it's an amazing thing around the marriage equality debate in New York. The people pushing for marriage equality boasted about the fact that they were working with four moderate Republicans and offering to fund their campaigns if they would vote yes, and they succeeded. Right? I mean, can you imagine if that was reversed, the outcry that there would have been around that issue? I mean, it is. I haven't seen it, that call vote buying in major media, but that is, they bought the votes to win on marriage equality in New York. So if they're buying, think about this: if they're buying votes on an issue like that, or if they want to buy the votes on an issue like that, what does that mean for all these other issues in terms of what they want to do with their money?
Professor, taking kind of the poli-sci side, I would like to see some more among reporters, and I know you have a hard job, expect to be an expert in everything when you interact with people who are, in some respects, they have a use for you guys. I would like to see just a bit of cognizance about the different types of campaign finances. As I said, there are hard contributions, these recorded contributions, and then there's this whole new world of Citizens United. And understanding the difference between the two, I think, is important. But also, I think, kind of from the editorial side, I think the openness is something that's a real concern. If nothing, it's kind of sad, or maybe we should be relieved. I'm not sure. Policy is very complex. But you're right when a lot of these corporations aren't giving because they're worried about the SEC regulations actually affecting FEC-type type of giving. So, I come from Minnesota originally and seen Target being pilloried in the press because they gave to a Republican candidate, and it was probably based on labor issues, but they were active in opposing marriage equality questions, which was something that ran counter to what Target did. So, understanding the nuances that, again, it's not all contributions are the same, not all money in politics is the same, and that's not to say it's benign, but it's important to distinguish between, the Adelsons of the world versus, someone like me who might click a button and contribute $50. Those are far different things, and I think we lump them all together as somehow being the same, and I don't think that's the case, and we should think hard about what that means.
Frank, but what don't you want us to write about? Because then we'll write about it.
Well, I think I would leave you with a couple things. I think it's important to know that lobbyists are the same people that we all are. They go to PTA meetings. They work and have their kids going to school and go to soccer games with their kids. They also happen to know a lot about politics. And they also happen to know a lot about how the inner workings of government operate. And I don't think that you should be accused of being a cheater or a liar because you operate within a system. And you operate within the system, and you operate within the system's rules in an effective way. So money in politics, yes. Can we do something about it? Probably not. Should we do something about it? I don't think we should. Are there things that we can do to make things more clear? Absolutely. And should we do that too? Yes. And I think, again, Professor Nockin might have said it best. Sunshine is the best antidote for a lot of these things. And so if you know what people are giving and you know who's doing a lot of the giving, you can be the judge and they can be the judge whether it's worth the price of admission.
Okay, well, I want to help you give a hand to the panelists for coming out today. Thank you very much.